Good morning. You're listening to Praxis, a local public affairs show hosted by me, Taylor Weech. This morning, I am flying solo. I've had a guest for every show so far since April, except for today. So you'll have to bear with me filling a whole hour all by myself. And thinking about what to do for this show without a guest, I obviously began thinking about all of my guests thus far in the last 2 months, and I've been really fortunate to interview a lot of really bright people doing a lot of varied actions. So the whole point of this show for me was to explore what can people do, people who want to make change, people who are dissatisfied with the society they live in, because that's kind of what political involvement's all about. Most of the time, people don't become politically involved because they love what's going on, because they're satisfied with the status quo. Some sort of dissatisfaction usually spurns people to get involved. And it's just really fascinating to me the multitude of ways that people have found to do that over the history of humanity, the history of politics. So learning about that and then really trying to focus on locally, you know, what are people doing in the city that I actually live in? Because when it comes down to it, that's what's important, is the place where you actually live, the culture you're participating in or not participating in, the factors that are going to most directly affect your life. And I think that that's often something that's overshadowed because local politics just isn't as glamorous. It doesn't have the same kind of exciting feel, I suppose, that national politics is given by our media. We have these elections that are kind of run like increasingly like reality shows or like wrestling matches or something. And it's very sensationalized and it's very, you know, hard hitting, and people are having these debates, and it's just the way that it's presented is so sensationalized. So I kind of wanted to just really back up and focus on what do people do? Not what do they talk about doing, but what do they actually do? Does it work? What are their issues? What are they fighting for? What are their methods? And most of all, do they work? And how can they be revised? So the thing that's been in common with all of these people is that they've all identified mostly a common enemy, I suppose. I don't like using this like war terminology, but that's kind of the way it's framed in a lot of cases. So the people I've interviewed, all of these activists, kind of have a common they that they're against. And it can be generalized as institutionalized wealth is basically the they that they're talking about. So corporate powers, individuals with a large amount of wealth who have a disproportionate influence in the system. And so I also thought it'd be interesting to look at the big they. I don't know what else to call them, but they. But what do they do? These mostly anonymous antagonists, you know, these big corporations and wealthy people and powerful politicians who have had power for a long time, entrenched families, basically entrenched power. What are their methods? And because they obviously are working if this is the group that's been winning for so long. And when you really look at it, their method was sort of divide and conquer through taking hold of all of the reins of control possible. I talked last week with my friend Van Nielsen, who's done extensive research into education, the history of the education system. And there's a lot of hundreds of years old influence by institutionalized wealth in our education system, funding different methodologies and making sure that they're implemented in schools. So that's one. I mean, to control the education system, control the minds of young people. Also, you know, the media, as we know, our corporate media is owned by six companies. So almost everything that you'll hear, with the exception of community radio, independent film, independent television, public access, what you'll hear is coming from, you know, six different mouthpieces. It might appear to have many different flavors, but it's really all coming from that one central source again. Also, you know, there's been a lot of effort over many, many years. My first guest was Kai Hushka, who teaches democracy school. And that's basically the history of institutionalized wealth rebuilding our political structure to their own benefit and to the disenfranchisement of normal people, meaning just average citizens. And so, yeah, that's how I would characterize their method. It's not a random occurrence that this small group of people have so much power in our country. You know, by no means should it be construed as being random or unintentional or anything like that. It's definitely been a long process of getting into each of the systems and really taking them over without sounding too much like a conspiracy theorist. So then if those are their methods, you know, how, what are individual people to do? It seems like such a daunting kind of massive superstructure to even begin to tackle. How do you get control of something that's really spun out of control and has power over all the tentacles of your society? And that's really the fundamental question I wanted to get at with this show when I started it. So now 2 months in, having talked to 8 or 9 different really outstanding individuals in Spokane, it's been very hopeful to just talk to these people and knowing that there's so many more people other than them who are working on similar issues. And they all have really distinctly different methods. And I thought it was really fascinating. So in case this is your first time listening to my show, or in case you've missed anything, I have kind of like a super recap of everything I've talked about. And, you know, I still don't have many conclusions about what the method is, like what the method of making change is. I don't think there is just one. But I think that having these conversations and talking to as many people as possible is really the only way to get close to understanding what needs to be done. So, as I mentioned, my first guest on the show was Kai Hushka. And he, along with many others, is part of Envision Spokane. And they have a really interesting angle because, like I said, they teach Democracy School, which is a crash course. It's a weekend-long crash course into the history of basically the Constitution of the U.S. and regulatory law in the U.S. So all of the laws that regulate what a person or corporation can or cannot do. And regulatory law is often the first step for many activists when something is happening that they don't want, when it's a reactive kind of struggle where there's something going on and a community doesn't want it. It's a factory farm coming in. They don't want it. They go and say, look, there's a law. The EPA has a law saying that you can't do this. So they sue the company on the basis of that law. And then they soon find that what happens is the company gets around that one law and wins the case because they can pay for better lawyers. They can pay endlessly, you know, to mitigate these things. And the law gets changed in a very minor way, but overall their structure still succeeds. So this is what they saw in history repeated over and over again, these lawyers who eventually founded Democracy School. And they came up with a new method that's kind of innovative in that it's really proactive. A lot of activism, I think, becomes reactive just on the basis of chaos, you know, crises happening. And that's a really visceral thing. A crisis comes to your community and you have to react. This is more of a theory of being proactive and saying, well, eventually this crisis could come to us. So what can we do in advance to make sure that we have a strong legal structure that protects citizens, that protects you and I from things like factory farms coming in, you know, a Walmart coming down the street from you and ruining a lot of things about your quality of life, etc. So that's what I really like about them, is they're trying to get ahead of this whole game that's controlled by the power elite. They're trying to go proactively into the law and rewrite it, ensuring that communities have rights commensurate to those of corporations. This has been interpreted as a really radical thing, because it is radical, but it's frustrating to see so many politicians fighting against something like this when they, as citizens, are also negatively affected by the disproportionate rights of corporations over individuals. So I really liked talking to Kai about that, and I think that the strength of their method is the proactivity of it, and the it's aggressive. You know, it's an aggressive step forward saying, we will not stand for this as it is now. That's what I really like about them. Unfortunately, their limitation, I think, is still partially public readiness to accept that. However, half of people in Spokane, 50% of voters, 49.2 or something like that, voted for their last community bill of rights, which was a proposal to basically put a Bill of Rights in Spokane City Charter, basically the equivalent of our Constitution as a city, saying, among other things, that we don't recognize corporate rights under Citizens United in the city of Spokane. That's pretty radical, and half of people voted for it. So I think that that's their biggest barrier now, is a lack of understanding and a lack of willingness to take such a drastic step. But I think that people are moving more in that direction and beginning to really understand what it means to have unlimited corporate free speech in the form of money in our politics. This election season by far has been the most highly spent and the most really negative, I think, and filled with attack ads and all of that. And people are starting to understand that that's really what corporate personhood means. It means an injection of really unlimited amounts of money into a process where it doesn't belong. So he was a great first guest to have, and it really made me think about a lot of things. And after that, I talked to Amanda Hunt, who is a really awesome young woman who is a student at Eastern and an intern at the Peace and Justice Action League. And they do a lot of direct action. And basically, direct action is any resistance, protest, directly confronting a specific issue. The Montgomery bus boycott would be an example of a direct action. And in the spring, Pajals helped put on, with MoveOn.org, Washington Community Action Network, helped put on a training on how to do direct action effectively in your community. And that's what Amanda and I talked about. And in a lot of ways, what they end up doing is that reactive work that I talked about, where it's something drastic is happening. There's huge budget cuts at the state level, and they need to react and go in and say, all of these people think that this is wrong, and we want you to take this course of action instead. It's generally a don't do this, do this instead type of message. And in that way, they're able to make targeted incremental changes. And they've had some success with this. And I'm going to play a quick clip from my interview with Amanda and find it right now. So I asked her, you know, what do you hope to accomplish, and what are some concrete goals of what you guys are doing? And this is part of what she had to say. You can also listen to our entire interview via podcast at kyrs.org if you go to my show page, Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. And here's Amanda.
I think that by us being able to organized together, we will be able to stand up for, you know, anything that we, I mean, as a coalition, I mean, one of the biggest things that we're fighting is the 1%, the rich not paying their taxes, corporations becoming people, all of these things. Okay. We can stand up as a collective voice and demonstrate against those things. Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, that was not, again, not accidental. That was a planned direct action, and they were able to accomplish a lot with that direct action. I think that if we all got together and we did, you know, direct actions like those in the areas that we're interested in, that it'll have a huge difference and impact. One of the biggest things that we're in our country that we're fighting with right now, like I said, is the 1%. Not paying their fair share. We see it here in Washington State. I work, you know, with Washington Community Action Network on local or on statewide issues. We have, we're lucky enough to have had our legislature close some important corporate tax loopholes. Mm-hmm. But we are not making the 1% in our state pay their fair share, not just in our state, throughout our country. And by advocating for them to pay their, you know, their fair share, one of the biggest things we were able to accomplish in our state is that they are starting to realize that that's an issue in legislature, and they were able to close one of the tax loopholes on big banks. It wasn't completely closed, but they were able to minimize the amount of tax deductions that these corporations are receiving. So people are starting to listen to us.
Okay.
And that didn't, you know, we've done a lot of direct action with Washington Can to push that forward. So that's one of the things that can be accomplished.
So she pointed to that as a success. And I think that that's really great that people have the dedication to fight those fights. But it's difficult because it's a lot more difficult. And I'll get into this when I talk about interviewing many of the people from Occupy. I think direct action works really well for a specific target like that. But in a broader movement and with a broader message, it's really, really difficult to remain clear about your objectives and to get enough people on board to make it work. basically, with those two first guests, what I found was that you can get a lot by being specific with your goals and by being targeted. And then, I mean, another, so the obvious issue to talk about when you're talking about politics, other than law and kind of the protesting method, is elections, because that's what we're told in our education, which we'll also talk about education a little because it's my favorite topic. That's kind of what we're told. This is your way to make a difference. This is your avenue into politics, is by voting for a specific candidate, for a specific party, and trusting this person to represent what you believe in. And so my third show, I believe, I interviewed my friend Emmett, who caucused for Ron Paul. And so he's a Ron Paul supporter, and he wanted to kind of find out what he could do through the election process and how could it work? How does it work? How does it not work? And how could he participate and make a difference? So that's something that he was really interested in. And I have a clip of him also talking about why would you do that? Why would you participate in a presidential election? And is it an effective way to make change, most importantly? So this is Emmett Hartley talking about why he chose to get involved in the Republican primary, why he chose to caucus, and what the results of that were.
And I recently made it a point to go to as many political events as I could, or all of the different things that the Republican Party does to pick its presidential nominee. I wanted to be there and see it with my own eyes, and just feel like I didn't want to be counted among those that didn't do anything. I know many people, I've spoken to many people in the last several months that feel like they just have this mentality that they don't really care what happens, or they care enough to think about it and talk about it, but they don't care about enough about it to actually try and have an influence on it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see for myself just how accessible it is and what really goes on. I would have never gotten involved with this at all if I didn't think that I could have some sort of voice in what happens, and I just wanted to see how much of a voice I could have. And so I decided to kind of throw down the gauntlet and put my heart and soul into it and make sacrifices to be there. And there weren't that many sacrifices to make. It was a very simple, easy thing to do. I just had to put a little bit of research into it and find out where to be and when. And
so that's Emmett Hartley talking about his experience caucusing, and he went on to talk about why he supports Ron Paul. Basically, you know, he's been very disenchanted by the two-party system, and he's been very disenchanted by Obama's presidency, by all presidencies before that, and especially with the banking system. He's all about fighting the influence of international banking in our government. So he went on, he talked a lot about his reasons for supporting Congressman Paul for president, and that being kind of him thinking that if one person with the right views got into office, they could really make a vast difference. We talked about his anti-war stance a lot, and how that alone, having a president who didn't believe in having a huge empire, huge military empire worldwide, what kind of difference that would make. And talked about how the rates at which veterans support Ron Paul. And I think that it has a lot of, that message is really powerful in that it is nice to think about what could someone with the power of the president do if they wanted to use their powers for good rather than evil. And it's a really tempting thing. And I can see how people get really swept up in, especially in presidential elections, but identity politics in general, you know, and getting behind the one person who's going to kind of save the day. And while maybe that could be possible, it's really difficult for me to imagine, I suppose, as a somewhat cynical person, thinking about, you know, does that really make a difference if the structure itself is broken? So that's kind of the issue that you come up against here, is does it make a difference if the structure is broken? Can you pick a person who's able to fix it? Is there a way to fix it by electing one person? and how does that really work? So it's kind of the same concept of, I see presidential elections in a similar way to the approach I just talked about with Envision Spokane, of going after one part of the regulatory law. It's a little piece, but if the broader scope isn't looked at and isn't addressed, then the little pieces don't really have as much of a chance to make a difference. So that's my qualm, I suppose, with using electoral politics as a vessel for making the changes you're interested in seeing, just because, you know, it's so specific and it's really an act of faith that I think a lot of people are at a point that they don't want to have that level of faith in their government or in one single person after being maybe burned so many times by our system. So that's upsetting and sad and disappointing, especially during a presidential election. No offense if you have all of your hopes cast in this presidential election. I don't know many people who do, since our choices are rather dismal. And that's sort of what I was driven to look at next is, you know, why are our choices so dismal? Why do we only have two choices, both in our state and our nation? This kind of, you know, chocolate or vanilla, Pepsi or Coke version of democracy being, I think, pretty transparently a joke. And that's what a lot of people I've spoken to believe, too, especially young people, I think, kind of realize that it doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. But then what do you do? So I went to my go-to independent candidate and independent election reform guru, who is John Waite, who I talk about politics with all the time. He's a former candidate for city council, and he really talks about these broad structural reforms, which is part of the reason he probably hasn't been elected. No offense, John, if you're listening, is that a lot of people don't want to talk about these broad issues. And that's something we addressed when I interviewed him. We talked about, you know, why just voting might not be enough and how independent candidates can be a way to break into the system to even the playing field a little bit. Because right now, if you don't have the support of a huge party, if you don't have the Democrats or the Republicans behind you, it's a big struggle to get your voice heard, especially in an election setting when there's so much money tied up in it. And it's really such a quagmire of special interests and money that needs to be spent. The numbers involved in a campaign are huge. So talk to John about that, and I have a clip of him as well talking much more eloquently about this issue than I can.
Now, there's such a fight. If you try to, like, think outside the box and you try to be, like, creative, people will fight it tooth and nail. And when I say people, it's like the establishment. I'm more of a Democrat than a Republican. I'm happy to say that. And if push come to shove and I had to make some decisions, I'd probably go that route. But, you know, I've talked about elections reform and campaign finance reform and, like, revising the top two generals so that people would have choices. And I've talked to, like, some of my buddies that are upper-up Democrats. Oh, God, how could I possibly say all these things? And no way, that's crazy, this won't work. And I was, like, trying to figure out what was going on, and it was pretty obvious that they were protecting their power structure. Mm-hmm. So while I appreciate that they're more forward-thinking, they still dropped back into their, like, defending the power base and defending their thing. And maybe their reasons are good. Maybe their reasons are, if I don't defend my thing, then the Republicans are going to, like, win or whatever.
That's really hard because now, I mean, just down the street, the Dems office is up and running. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who are staunch Democrats who work so hard on those campaigns. They're great people. Right. We have a lot of the same ideas. But, you know, I just don't think that their way works, and it's made for some tense conversations lately.
Right.
But I mean,
I always have to tell them, I don't hate you. I want a thing that you're not providing me, and I want a thing that you're not providing me. And the moment that I saw them talking about really fighting for, like, open ballot access, expanded party representation, you know, more representation for people that are not Democrats or Republicans, I would jump behind whoever said that. And mm-hmm. I don't care if they're left, right, center, Republican, Democrat. You know, I'm looking for people that understand the system is broken. Mm-hmm. And it's the structural and systemic stuff that needs to be addressed, and not this, like, you know, cutting military spending and gay marriage and, you know, all this. I want people to fix the system,
mm-hmm.
or do both. Yeah. They can do both. They could talk about all the things that are, you know, tug at people's hearts. But also, I need them to be honest about the system. Mm-hmm. And right now, I'm not seeing any honesty. And that's mm-hmm. why, I mean, I would love to start being able to, like, look for people that want to be alternative candidates. I would jump behind them and help them out.
So that was John Waite talking about his views about independent candidates and also making an offer if you are an independent candidate to he says he'll back you there on the air. So if you need to get in touch with John Waite, he's just there at Merlin's. And he and I talked for a long time, not only on the air, but just in general, about how to do that, how to really get substantial about talking about elections reform and issues like that when the conversation's so dominated by these kind of hot button social issues that people hold so dear, you know, for understandable reasons, because those issues like gay marriage, civil rights issues do affect your daily life. And that becomes a challenge for people to kind of overcome their emotional attachment to issues and look at what's the broader change that needs to happen. So I don't know if I still have an answer for that either. We talked a lot about how could elections reform come in when there's these people with entrenched power who have an interest in not reforming the system. And, you know, we really didn't come to any conclusions on that. And it's really hard to say what is the solution in all of these cases, it turns out. So that's going to be an ongoing issue for me. It's going to be an ongoing issue for, I think, anyone who wants to be involved in this kind of work. But it's really important that we have the conversation and that we open it up. So if you have any input on this, on creating change, on being involved in politics, on what methods you've seen that work and don't work, I would be more than happy to take your calls in the studio. Our number is 509-747-3807. So if you'd like to share your opinion with me on the air, you have about half an hour to do so. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor Weech, talking about just kind of a retrospective of the last 2 months of doing this show, all the great people I've been able to talk to and what their views are, what their issues are, and most of all their methods, and are their methods working. So far, I mean, we talked about remaking the laws themselves, talked about going after specific portions of the laws that don't work, talking about, you know, electing the right person. Is it a question of electing the right person? Is it a question of opening up the process so that the right person has the visibility to be elected at all? And then really, how can a broader movement happen? Because that's what this is building to, is something broader, because there's a lot of organizations that work on the pieces, you know, that work on specifically environmental legislation, or who work on gay marriage issues, or who work on human rights issues, creating new economic structures. But we're really at a point, a lot of people believe, that we need to address the entire system if we want any of that to be effective, that none of this work can be truly effective until we have a different broad system to work within. And that's kind of the way I see the entire Occupy movement, is an attempt to address that broad system. And it's had mixed results, as we all know. And I was really fortunate to have three excellent local folks who have been involved in Occupy Spokane since really about the beginning. Justin Ellenbecker, Pastor Deb Conklin, and William Cruz. I had them all in the studio for an Occupy roundtable, which was really fascinating. When my broken wrist is healed, I'll have a video from that edited and uploaded also, so that you can watch it if you're a visual person. That'll be on kyrs.org. And it was really interesting to speak with them, because they have a lot of direct experience in Spokane of trying to organize something broader, trying to communicate a broad message and making it something people identify with, but also having it not be a fringe thing. Because part of Occupy, their whole strength of their slogan is, we are the 99%. And that implies that we're almost all in this together. And that's been a struggle for the movement at large, is to how to get people to look past their differences and really truly collaborate on a meaningful level and make real change happen. Because that's the difficult part. You know, it's great to have a march and have the choir there, you know, be preaching to the choir, but to really get everyone involved, including, you know, the police, the city officials, and everyone who could possibly need to be involved, having everyone's voice at the table and having everyone heard. So this is a clip of that Occupy Roundtable with Justin Ellenbecker, William Cruz, and Deb Conklin. I think Will speaks first, then Deb, then Justin in this clip, but I'm not positive. You can listen to the whole thing, podcast on KYRS.org. And yeah, they are just a talented, really bright group of people. And it was a privilege to get to talk to all of them at once because they really build on each other's ideas really well. So this is the three of them talking about how to build collaborations and what the successes of Occupy Spokane have been. What else has been working so far in Spokane specifically? And what have been the challenges?
I'll speak to one of those things. I think Bethany Copeland did something amazing, I think, with Turnout Against Citizens United. I think with some of the things, and Deb's been on this team, and I think you actually have been on the team, too, and working with the city. You got a meeting with the mayor.
Yes.
And actually, I think the Franklin Park outreach is another example of what we've been able to accomplish with the city. We're one of three cities, is that correct, that have passed a resolution in favor of Occupy, which I think is somewhat historic. And I think it's because we decided to keep a positive relationship with the city.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the Franklin Park outreach specifically, we pushed back against the permitting process and got them to extend our stay there by several days in spite of not having a permit, without violence, without arrests, without et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about the whole, I've had this conversation with a lot of people involved in this and just in theory, getting permits from a city, you know, the whole concept of asking permission to protest. I understand that it's a concession that you have to make in some cases. Is that your opinion on it?
Well, I think we have to be careful. The reason I was willing to work on the permit, and I did, was because we were using a park. And one of the conversations we had back and forth, because some people were saying, we need to just be able to go in and take over the park and do what we want to. And I'm kind of going, you know, I care about our parks. I think our parks are an important part of the city. And we need to work with the Parks Department to make sure that what we're doing isn't going to damage the park. If we had been, you know, on a street or someplace else, that would have been a different question. But this question really was about working with Leroy ID and the Parks Department to say, how can we do what we need to do to express our protest without doing anything that's going to damage the park? And I think that collaboration actually was positive.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. And I see one of the key points that that we must continually critically evaluate is whether things must be reformed or revolutionized. Each and every one of these issues has to be tackled in that sort of way. One of the key tenets of nonviolence is that you do not try to approach somebody who disagrees with you as your enemy and in an attempt to force them to come to your side because it is more logical and better and more ethical, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. No, you try to find ways to win the individuals over, finding common ground under which you can agree on. These individuals who are working on the parks boards and with the parks department, they care in some way, shape, or form for some of the things that we care about.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can find those areas of middle ground and then possibly be able to extend that bridge and make it all the more stronger, then why not? The key goal here is to not go to war with those who have already declared war on us. It's to let them know, you know what? You're actually on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great point. Most of Spokane is Main Street. It's not Wall Street. Even the police department are union men and women. And when the budget cuts come, police and fire are among the first to suffer. So, you know, it takes some sophistication, actually, in your worldview to not be constantly adversarial. It's a little bit adolescent, actually. It's easy to be adversarial. It's easy to create straw men in situations and get angry every single time. You know? And I'm the guy that was just preaching radicalism earlier, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. If people are willing to negotiate, If you border your neighbor, you have to negotiate. You have to compromise. That is, in essence, politics.
Well, that's Will Cruz most recently talking about the Occupy Spokane and how they've had a lot of success collaborating with the city, getting permits, working with even the police department. And that a lot of people don't immediately think of that when they think of organizing. They think of it as being a very adversarial thing. And I really enjoy what he talks about, and Deb and Justin, all of them talking about nonviolence. And I think it's a very mature stand to take. And I think it's really the only thing that makes sense. You can't bring the hypocrisy into the equation of saying we're a more morally righteous movement than you, and then using violence just doesn't really make sense. So that, after having that show and talking to them, especially with Deb being a pastor, she's also involved in an organization called the Oak Tree. And the following week after that roundtable, I interviewed Joel Williamson, who helped to start the Oak Tree. And if you want to talk about moral righteousness, they are a group of mostly Christian organizers. Different churches are involved, different religions, you know, and secular folks, non-religious people as well. And the Oak Tree is a really fascinating organization to me because they're all about building power through relationships and building organizational strength through knowing each other better, and kind of this more touchy-feely, I suppose, angle on how to make change. So they started by just getting together in a church basement, as many revolutions have begun, just talking about what do we have in common? You know, what is our common ground? How can we build a solid foundation? That's kind of their metaphor of the oak tree, you know, this trunk of a solid foundation between each other to be able to effectively work together to make change. So they started by building a community. And one of their key events that I think is really interesting is the story gathering, where one person, this happens once a month, I think on the second Sunday at Salem Lutheran Church, one person will just simply tell their story. And that's a really strange way for a lot of people to spend a Sunday afternoon. And a lot of people wonder what that could possibly have to do with politics, just to listen to someone tell a story. But really, stories are how we've always communicated. That's the foundation of every culture, is what are our stories? And it's a really interesting manifestation of people power, you know, to, rather than accepting the stories that are given to us through the media, through our education, through our, you know, six group ownership media mouthpiece, rather than accepting those stories as the stories of our culture, really honoring each other's stories and saying, you know, what happened to you that made you believe the things you believe? And I will try to understand that, and then we can more effectively work together. That's the theory behind it. It really dovetails with what they were just saying, the Occupy group on the clip I just played were saying about, you know, if you're going to border your neighbor, cooperate with them. And in order to have cooperation, you need to have empathy. And in order to have empathy, you have to have understanding. So that's really the main work of the Oak Tree, is to just build understanding between individual people to build a stronger group. And that's a really, I think, overlooked part of organizing and about politics, is that it's individual human beings who are involved. It's really easy to make it abstract. And I think it's really intentionally made abstract so that people look past that part about us all being human and needing to cooperate, because at the end of the day, we're interdependent and we do depend on each other in a society and even just in nature. And that is the strength of the Oak Tree, I think. And also that they don't discriminate against anyone. And a lot of people will self-select out of a group like that because it's led by Christian folks. But the fact of the matter is, this is the most tolerant group of religious people I've ever experienced. There's no dogma. There's no pushing anything down your throat. It's just really an effort, much like I've had with this show, to just question what's going on, think about different ways of doing things, and, you know, make change that way. So sorry about that ramble, but I just really love their organization, and it's based on a compassionate platform. So that's something I think is key, is compassion. And so, okay, the Oak Tree, compassionate platform, understanding one another. That's kind of where I started to step away from only examining institutions on this show and only examining how to interface with institutions, but also with other people. And a lot of it comes down to what people already know and how they were raised, and especially how they were educated. So that's what I decided to go for next. And that's a really, really big topic. I didn't even realize how big the topic of education would be, even though it's something I've explored a lot and I'm really passionate about, working with young people and just being a young person and having so recently come through our K-12 education system. So I wanted to examine why it is the way it is, why it seems to churn out such vast numbers of unprepared people, people who really aren't prepared to participate in a democracy, aren't prepared to participate in a workforce, aren't prepared to critically analyze much of anything, and then are expected to do all of those things and really disenfranchised when they can't do it, even though they've never been given an opportunity to build the skills, if that makes sense. So my friend Van is a kind of self-taught expert on this because he started in his college career to see the faults in the education he'd received, both in elementary, high school, and in college. And he was really frustrated by it, and he began to supplement his own education. So, and that I think is kind of a revolutionary action in a lot of ways. A lot of people don't think about their own education as being something that important. It's something that we all just do, and we don't really think about it. Even when being in school, you're not really examining the reasons you're in school. It's really given to you as this is your platform to social mobility. If you finish high school, you'll be able to go to college. And if you finish college, you'll be able to have a job. We're now seeing increasingly that that's not the case. And it's by no means a guarantee of a job. And we talked a little bit about how can we fix that? How can we create able humans who can effectively take on challenges the likes of which we've never really seen, in my opinion. I think humanity's at a point where there's so much, there's so many vast systems at play, there's so much going on that we really need to be mentally prepared to address these things. And without a solid education and without a foundation, I feel like that preparedness is much more difficult to come by. And even having just a conversation is a lot more difficult if people don't have the language to use, if people don't really know how to step back and analyze their own views. So this is just a little clip. We started talking about solutions finally. We spent 2 weeks talking about education and only got about 15 minutes of solutions in, just because there's so much history of how we got to where we got with the system we have, and just the depth that a lot of people don't realize of our system really being built by wealthy industrialists to guarantee having a labor force that's not well-educated enough to examine their role in society. That's really what he revealed to me through primary source texts and through a depth of research that he completely cited. This isn't just his idea that he came up with. It's not his crazy conspiracy theory. It really is true if you take a factual look at the past. But this is part of the happy part where we began to talk about solutions, thankfully, after all that time. So here's Van Nielsen talking about that just last week with me live in the studio. There's all kinds of ways to go to school for free. It's just a matter of how do you document it and how do you communicate it to people.
Right, and using the wealth of resources that you have around you with people who already have real-life job experience as opposed to people who have been trapped in the institution their entire lives and who are teaching you how to enter a workforce that they're really not giving you a solid approach at. I mean, if they're using these things like psychology and sociology to indoctrinate these desirable behaviors, yet if you start studying these theories and these primary texts in sociology and psychology, you really start to turn the tables around and go, oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique view. It's in a sense, it's a shift in perception.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think that students themselves, teachers and parents can acknowledge the problems with the schooling system we have and move past it to something else?
It's all in the independent will. Like we talked about the schooling system supplementing the Prussian single will or the uniform will of the collective over the individual. What I would advocate is a revival of individual inquiry, I would say.
Van Nielsen talking about individual inquiry being the solution for a lot of these problems. And if you're just a person who has the ability to step back, think about what they're being told, and really process it in a way that makes sense, then you'll be much better equipped to deal with the problems of the world, begin to organize, begin to make change in a way that makes sense for you, and even just to make a good life for yourself. I think that it's impossible to do that without an understanding of yourself and how you work, how you fit into the broader scheme, and what you can do, what you have the freedom to do, what you have the intellectual will to do. And that's really what it came back to for me. So I'm thinking about all of these people I've interviewed, thinking about all of the multitude of issues that we have. And in a lot of ways, this sounds like a cop-out, but it really just comes down to individual people being conscious, you know, doing their best to expand their consciousness of the world they live in and their role in it. That's huge. If people don't do that, then all of the voting and all of the protesting in the world won't do anything, because people won't be prepared to enjoy the fruits of what they've accomplished and won't be able to really objectively examine what they're doing and accomplish it in the first place. That's kind of where I'm at now. And a lot of that, talking to Joel about the oak tree was really helpful. I think that that's the role, the overlooked role of spirituality or religion or whatever you care to identify it as. Even if it's just your political philosophy, it's important, I think, to be grounded in something like that. That's what I'm finding more and more. And it's just an interesting thing to think about, too, to think about what's my role in the whole picture. And to step back and take some time to do that is really important. And one of my favorite people that I've found who's been really helpful in my life with this is a man called named Alan Watts. And he lectures about Zen and about all kinds of things. But this is just a really interesting lecture of his about people's resistance to doing that, people's resistance to self-examination, and what can be done. So, and how you might be able to just step back, relax, and realize what you need to do. So I'm going to play that for you, and I'm hoping that it's going to work, because this computer's had some technical issues today. So here we go. I believe that this is going to work. I hope you do too.
Supposing that I say to you, each one of you is really the great self, you know, the Brahman. And you say, well, all you've said up till now makes me fairly sympathetic to this intellectually, but I don't really feel it. What must I do to feel it really? My answer to you is this. You ask me that question because you don't want to feel it really. You're frightened of it. And therefore, what you're going to do is you're going to get a method of practice so that you can put it off. So that I can say, well, I can be a long time on the way getting this thing. And then maybe I'll be worthy of it after I have suffered enough. See, because we are brought up in a social scheme whereby we have to deserve what we get. And the price that one pays for all good things is suffering. But all of that is precisely postponement, because one is afraid here and now to see it. If you had the nerve, you know, real nerve, you would see it right away. Only that would be, you know, when one feels you shouldn't have nerve like that. Why, that would be awful. That would be That wouldn't do at all, because after all, I'm supposed to be poor little me, and I'm not really much of a muchness, and I'm playing the role of being poor little me, and therefore, in order to be something great, like a Buddha or a Jivanmukta, one liberated in this life, I ought to suffer for it. So you can suffer for it. There are all kinds of ways invented for you to do this. And you can discipline yourself, and you can gain control of your mind, and you can do all sorts of extraordinary things. I mean, you can drink water in through your rectum and do the most fantastic things. But that's just like being able to run the 100 yards in 9 seconds, or push a peanut up Mount Tamalpais with your nose, or any other kind of accomplishment you want to engage in. There's absolutely nothing to do with the realization of the self. The realization of the self fundamentally depends on coming off it. You know, the sort of, when we say to people who put on some kind of an act and say, oh, come off it.
and some people can come off it. They laugh and say they suddenly realize, you know, they were making fools of themselves, and they laugh at themselves and they come off it. So in exactly the same way, the guru, the teacher, is trying to make you come off it. Now, if he finds he can't make you come off it, he's going to put you through all these exercises so that you, at the last time, when you've got enough discipline, and enough suffering, and enough frustration, you'll give it all up and realize you were there from the beginning and there was nothing to realize. But the guru is very clever. He says, all right, if this is the way you have to go, this is the way you have to go. You asked for it. You came to me, I didn't invite you, you see, the guru says. You came to me and I said, I want to learn yoga. Well, he said, yoga is union. You're tattvamasi, you know, you're that. Well, no, you say, I'm sorry, I don't understand that, because I only get it intellectually, I don't feel it. Oh, he says, you're one of those. So, I've got to satisfy you, the customer is always right. No, I've got to give you all this work to do. Because you can't see directly that this is so. But he's looking at you in a funny way, you see. The guru is always saying to you, you know, what are you doing? What's your game? Imagine, for example, a father confessor. And you feel terribly guilty that you've committed murders and robberies and adulteries and fornications and all kinds of arson and injury to people and financial shenanigans. And you go to this man and say, I am a terrible sinner. Oh, he says, really? He said, I have murdered somebody. He says, how many times? And you think, oh, good Lord, this man doesn't realize how awful I am. And you recite all these things. He's perfectly calm. And then you say to him, well, you don't seem to be very shocked. He said, you haven't confessed any serious sins. He said, what do you mean by a serious sin? Well, he said, what do you think? Well, I don't know, I just feel wrong. I just feel there's something in the basis of me that feels, that tells me that I am not what I ought to be. Could it be that I'm spiritually proud? That I'm egocentric? He says, no, this is not, this is very usual, this is quite ordinary sin. But he says, you are guilty of something. Something really terrible. And what could that be? Well, I have no idea. Now he says, come on, come on. Go deeper. What is the real sin you've committed? You think, what, me? I, little me, could do something worse than murder, than worse than spiritual pride? Does little me? I mean, I'm a reasonably well-intentioned person. What could that be? And he looks at you in a funny way. He says, you know. You know, it's a kind of a Kafkaesque situation where you're accused of a crime that's not specified, and yet the accuser says, you jolly well know what you've done. Of course, we can't mention it. because it's like those laws that are on the books in the state of California and several other states where people are accused of the abominable crime against nature. Nobody knows what it is. I mean, it can't be mentioned. It's too dreadful to be talked about. So this guy does the same thing, but it's in a different dimension. You've done it. Now, what did you do? See, the real crime is that you won't admit you're God. That's false modesty. So the guru challenges, you see. He challenges you. If you raise the question, he doesn't go out and preach in the streets. Say, come on, everybody, you ought to be converted. He sits down under a tree and waits. And people start coming around, and they offer him propositions. He answers back. And he challenges you.
in any way that he thinks is appropriate to your situation. Now, if you've got a thin shell and your mask is easily dispatched with, he simply uses what we might call an easy method. He says, listen, Shiva, come up it. Don't pretend you're this guy here. I know who you are. And the guy sort of twinkles a bit and says, well, I guess you're right. But the people aren't like that. They have very thick shells. And so he has to invent ways of cracking them. So here is how it goes.
And that was Mr. Alan Watts talking about what individuals can kind of realize about themselves, realizing the power of one person and, you know, really your fundamental interdependence with others. So if nothing else, food for thought for your Monday. Covered a lot today, and thanks for listening, talking about all of the different ways that people organize, all of the different ways that people develop a higher consciousness of how they fit into things, and all of the things that you can do. This has been Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor Weech. We're live every Monday morning at 10 a.m., also podcasting on kyrs.org. You can hear all past shows on there. And thanks to Flip, who just called in during that lecture and talked a lot about his own political awakening. And I hopefully got him hooked up with some resources. So you're always welcome to call into the studio. We'd love to hear your feedback and have a great day. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.